Hi, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Reid Graff. We talk automotive maintenance and repair every month or so, and we're doing it today. We welcome back Gordon Fricke, owner and operator of Barber & Fricke Automotive in Hoosick Falls, New York. Gordon has been in the automotive repair and service industry for over 30 years, and boy, does he know his stuff. If you have a question, get in now, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. While he was trained in Germany and knows German cars inside and out, it's a domestic, give him a call. It's a Japanese car, give him a call, 1-800-348, or, you know, a Saab, 1-800-348-2551. You can also check in online, visit the Vox Pop section of our website, wamc.org/voxpop, to see all the ways you can get in touch with us via Twitter and Facebook and the World Wide Web. Of course, email as well, voxpop@wamc.org. But we do like your calls at 800-348-2551. With that said, Gordon Fricke, welcome back.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
I had my car, one of our cars inspected yesterday. You know, the price keeps going up. Back in the old days, it was less than $10.
Yes.
What goes into an inspection?
Well, you know, it's actually a lot of good things in terms of safety. The state has a little set of guidelines that they want shops like us to check.
Mm-hmm.
Steering components, tie rod ends, brake condition, all of your lighting, your windshield wipers, glass, windshield, mirrors, all the safety stuff. And there's also, which is not a new thing, but we also have to plug in vehicles to check for emissions.
Yep.
So if
that's not that new, no.
Not really, no. It's got to be 5 or 6 years old now for the plug-in test. But if that nasty little check engine light is on, that's going to be a trip up as far as this inspection program goes.
Yep. So anything, in other words, not every check engine light, or is it every check engine light?
Yes, if the computer has turned on the check engine light, that means that something having to do with emissions could be giving a problem, and that alerts the driver to get it checked, and that light is on. So the state has decided that if that light is on, the car could be polluting, and it needs to be resolved before they'll issue an emissions inspection.
Even if the check engine light has nothing to do with that?
The premise is that the components that they're checking can affect emissions.
Okay.
And there is some gray area because there are some transmission codes that will turn on the check engine light. And the question then is, how could a transmission problem have anything to do with emissions?
Yeah.
And that's debatable. But they may say that it's not shifting properly, the engine's revving up too high, it's not going into overdrive. So it's in there. Unfortunately, we have to deal with it.
1-800-348-2551 is our number. Gordon Fricke is our guest. And to the phones we go. Robert in Smith's Landing, you're first.
Good afternoon, Gordon.
Hi, how are you?
You are always on the ball with the answers. Alternator output. Does it really matter which... these are the GM alternators that came out in 64 when... into the 70s, the standard casing.
Yep.
They come anywhere from 46 to 69 amps. Is there really a difference as far as like for your basic car that doesn't have a whole lot of accessories other than music?
In other words, you're going to retro this alternator into something else? Is that what you're saying?
No, they already have alternators, but I noticed that I've been trying to get the largest amperage out of a case, which I think comes out to about 68 amps. On the old casing, and they come in one-wire, two-wire, and
yes.
three-wire configurations.
Yeah, yep.
I noticed that the one-wire ones require an excitement, but other than having that, they're much simpler with the wiring. So I tend to like those.
Yes.
Is there an advantage to using the multiple wires?
Not really. I mean, you don't have to. And Delco has made that alternator super easy to put into other vehicles.
Right.
Farm tractors, implements, anything that maybe had a generator in its earlier life and you want to get it switched to an alternator, these Delco one-wire systems are absolutely the easiest things to put in. They self-regulate. It charges when it needs to. And it doesn't matter amperage. I mean, you could put the highest amp they make if your vehicle has a lot of loads on it. If it doesn't have much of anything going on in terms of loads like new cars do, anything that they produce is adequate.
Mm.
No, right. These are basically good old American muscle. I noticed that the two cars which I have, which have rear batteries in the trunk, they seem to put out a little less voltage. I guess that's because of the ohmage and the long line going from the trunk to the... I'm using the thickest cable I can find. I think it's called welder's cable.
Yeah.
That I made myself.
Yep, that's a good idea.
But they seem to only put out, let's say, 13.6 instead of the 14.2. I guess there's no getting around that because of the length of the wire. Am I correct?
You mean you're checking the voltage at the battery in the trunk when your engine's running?
The voltmeter's on the dashboards.
Okay.
They all have gauges.
Yeah. The length of the wire definitely makes a difference, but there's a lot of cars with rear with trunk-mounted batteries. BMWs, Minis, Audis for a number of years. So there was a lot of cars with rear-mounted batteries. But I think in your case you're going to be fine. I would choose the higher amp unit because why not have a little extra oomph there? You know?
Yeah, they're all big block cars basically, and. I'm leaning towards putting MSD 6As in there also, which might help the spark a little bit.
The MSDs do draw some current, so I would pick the bigger alternator just to be...
That explains it, because some of the cars with the MSDs seem to have a little less on the voltmeter.
Yeah.
There you go. All right, Robert, thanks a lot for the call. Okay, so we've said this before, but I had an old car that had a generator. What's the main difference between a generator and the alternators, which came in later?
Yeah, well, the alternator produces alternating current. That's why they called it an alternator.
So the generator is DC all the way?
Yeah, exactly.
So how could you swap out an alternator into a car that is made, an electrical system made for a generator?
Well, it's a good question, but the alternator has components in it which convert the alternating current to direct current.
Ah.
They're called diodes.
So it comes out of the box the same.
Yeah, comes out DC, comes out at, it really isn't 12 volts, but it's a 12-volt system. But charging, like Rob said on the last call, 13.6, 14.2, that's your running voltage.
So why change it then? In other words, if they're both the same at the end, why go from generators to alternators?
The generator is way less efficient.
Ah,
it doesn't produce much at slow speeds and at idle. It's just an antiquated device for generating power.
Okay. Back to the phones. And Diana in Amherst, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My daughter was involved in an accident about 6 weeks ago in our 2010 Prius. She was essentially T-boned in the passenger side rear wheel well, and with enough of an impact to spin the car 360, her glasses went flying off. She was very scared. My question is that I'm concerned about her continuing to drive that particular model because the airbags didn't go off. And I can't understand, isn't that the point of airbags? That,
yes.
You know, I mean, if you were hit with that much impact to
yep.
spin the car 360 degrees, why didn't they go off?
That's a very often asked question after a car crash, and front airbags, for example, are not going to deploy every time you get into a frontal impact unless it is generally within 30 degrees of the front of the car, and the force has to be sufficient enough to turn on the decelerometers or the impact sensors, and they have to agree with the third sensor in the computer that it's really time to turn the airbags on, because you certainly don't want them deploying at every bump.
Yep.
So it's a very, very sophisticated, good system. It has to be that's just the way they're designed. So that has to do with the fronts. Your vehicle or your daughter's vehicle was in not a full-blown side impact, though, because it hit the rear corner of the car and spun it.
Right.
And I'm sure that was not enough to trip the side airbags in that car.
Huh.
And
okay.
The airbags are so good and so highly developed that the system self-checks constantly.
Mm.
And if that yellow airbag warning light comes on and stays on, the system found a fault somewhere and it's warning the driver that the system may not work. So providing that the airbag light comes on and then goes off after its test, which is some seconds, maybe 8, 10. The system is up and ready to roll. I just don't think that car was in the right it didn't suffer the right impact to need to turn those airbags on.
Okay.
Okay, should we have the airbags tested?
The system self-checks.
Is there a way to test them?
Yeah, just turn the key on, don't start it, make sure the airbag symbol comes on, and make sure it goes off after the car's running.
All right.
Okay, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Diana, thank you very much. 1-800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. So if your light comes on and your airbag light comes on, is that an inspection killer?
No.
No?
It is not. When we inspect a vehicle with the airbag light on, there's a part of the test that asks the inspector whether the light illuminated and then whether the light went out after the engine was started.
Hmm.
And you have to answer it, but it doesn't fail the car.
So why ask the question?
I think it's because of keeping records. Let's say this particular car got in a crash 3 days later and a lawsuit ensued. Somebody might say, let's pull some records. The car was just inspected 2 days ago. Let's see if the airbag light was illuminated.
Why is the state in the business of helping the
litigation? I don't know if they are, but I have a feeling it's for statistics or record keeping, because they asked the question, but it doesn't fail the car.
Yet. All right, let's take a break. 1-800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke is our guest, and we'll be back.
Support for WAMC comes from Cafe Capriccio, featuring Chef Jim Rua's book, Cafe Capriccio's Chef's Table, online and at the Bookhouse in Albany, New York, cafecapriccio.com. Curtis Lumber, providing kitchens, baths, doors and windows, paint, flooring, and more since 1890. With 21 locations in New York and northern Vermont, curtislumber.com. Snow Farm, Williamsburg, Massachusetts, a New England craft program offering workshops for adults and teens taught by master craftspeople on a 50-acre farm. Snowfarm.org. And Casual Set, Stuyvesant Plaza, featuring modern women's fashions and accessories, serving the Capital Region for over 40 years. 518-482-7136.
Vox Pop on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke is our guest. I'm Ray Graff, and back to the phones. Jim in the Hartford area. Is that Hartford, Connecticut, or New York?
Hartford, Connecticut, sir.
All right, you're on.
Well, thank you very much. Good afternoon. Mr. Fricke, I have a 2003 Chevrolet Silverado truck. I'm driving it hands-free right now, being
safe.
Here in Connecticut. I have to do the rear brake pads, and I'm doing the rotors, and in the process, I know that the backing plates, the guard plates, are rotted through.
Yep.
To get the axles, rear axles off, to be able to replace the four-bolt flange, once I remove the distributor cover, am I still going to see that same bolt that takes the big pin out so that I can reach inside and access the two clips to drift both axles out of the differential?
Yeah, to allow those axles to slide out, and you were a little bit broken up, but I think what you've got to do is take the differential cover off. And maybe
yes.
You said that.
Yes.
Yeah, and there are going to be, you're right, there's going to be some big C-clips in there or C-washers, and there's a pin that you have to remove that unblocks those axles so you can push them in a quarter or half an inch to get those lock clips out.
Uh-huh.
So there's, and it's all pretty easy. There's a bolt that holds the pin that holds the gears in, that has to come out.
Yep.
Then you can nudge the axles in and pull those C clips out, and then the axle just slides right out of the tube. It's not bad really to do that.
No, it isn't. I've done them years ago, but I didn't know if the later models have changed.
It's essentially the same.
Good. Quick thing on emissions. I did have to R&R a fuel pump not too long back, and shortly thereafter I did get the check engine light. And when I did check the code on it, it sends me to this little vapor canister affair with, I assume, a 12 volt the coil in it, a solenoid. Okay, this plastic container on the driver's side, just near the filler tube, looks like about the size of a small can of vegetables for $82.
Yeah.
Is there any way I can get in there and troubleshoot that? Like maybe apply voltage to those two pins and see if I can hear the solenoid change state, or even just take an ohmmeter to them to see if the coil's open or whatever?
Yes, the answer is yes and yes. You can put an ohmmeter across those pins, and that'll tell you if your coil has an open circuit. And then and those solenoids do operate on 12 volts, so you can provide them with power and ground and listen for the clicking.
Will a surge kill them?
No. And it is common on that truck to have that purge canister solenoid fail. And there was an update available. So you change that, and they reroute the vent hose, and it's a little kit. You can buy that kit now through some of your auto parts stores, and it might even be an AC Delco brand. But I can't tell you that's what's wrong with it, but we see a lot of those failing.
Okay. Jim, thanks a lot.
Thank you, and have a pleasant day.
Drive safely. And over to Matt on the cell phone. Where are you calling from, Matt?
Post-it kill.
All right. Well, you're on.
My wife has a 2005 Hyundai Elantra that has 90,000 miles on it. It makes a loud noise when it starts up, and I think it's the power steering pump. And when she moves the wheel when she's not in motion, would a loud noise, kind of a squealy noise, be a power steering pump? And would that have anything to do with a timing belt and a water pump we just recently had changed?
If that whining noise changes or gets louder when you're steering the car at a stop, are you getting that?
Yeah, yes, we are.
Okay. Have you checked the fluid level, the power steering fluid level?
I have not.
Okay. You could be slightly low on power steering fluid, and that's what's causing that screaming sound.
Yeah.
I would first check it, top it. If the noise goes away, that's great. But look around just to see if you don't have a leak somewhere, because you know, once in a great while you should top it up, because some does evaporate out of the container, but not a lot. But that's where I would go. And I doubt it's related to the timing belt job if you've pinpointed the source of the noise and it is the power steering noise.
If we had to replace that power steering pump, how much would that be with parts and labor, roughly, ballpark?
You know, I couldn't really guess, because the price of parts and the labor times change so much from car to car. But
yeah.
Once you see that that's the case, you can investigate and you can make some calls and see how much they're costing.
Thank you very much.
Matt, thank you very much. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Gordon Fricke is our guest today. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Jill in Waterford. Hi, Jill. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. You're on.
I came in a bit late when you were talking about the check engine light and inspections.
Mm-hmm.
Did I understand you that whenever if the check engine light is on during an inspection, that it automatically fails?
Yes, that's true. If you brought your car into the shop for a state inspection and the check engine light was on while the engine was running, it won't pass the emissions test.
Okay. In that case, I have had my check engine light come on for something as little as a loose gas cap.
Ah, but it could be more than a loose gas cap.
The loose gas caps are very common because...
Yeah, and that's so ergo, I'm thinking, okay, a loose gas cap could cause me to fail inspection.
Yes, because the premise is that if the gas tank is not sealed, particularly in hot summer weather, hydrocarbons or gas vapors can evaporate out of the gas tank and get into the atmosphere. That's why the tanks are sealed and the vapors are recaptured.
But I've had a situation in an older car that I've had a few years ago that it said check gas cap, but in fact it was this evaporator sensor in the fuel, in the emission system.
Yeah, yeah. Some cars do say check gas cap, and they're just alerting the driver that, hey, wait a minute, it could be this simple. check your cap first. If it's loose, let's say you forgot to put it on at the gas station, that'll take care of it.
Yeah.
But there definitely, it could be more things.
But I'm with because you, Jill. It's a lot of extra money if it's something that simple. But, of course, if you fail and it's just the gas cap, it doesn't cost to have it reinspected, does it?
Well, every time the car gets reinspected, yes, there is a reinspection fee. It's less than the full inspection.
God. Oh, boy.
Yeah. I never knew that. Yeah. I mean, I've never failed inspection, thank God.
Well, just make sure the light is not on. And it has to have turned itself off. You can't just have
clear the codes.
Yeah, you can't just clear the codes. It has
can't
to
clear the codes.
Has to be off for on its own.
How would they know if you just cleared the codes and then drove in?
The states they're ahead of that game too, because the readiness tests will not have been completed, and it'll come up saying your car did not complete its tests yet. Fail.
Ah, that stinks.
Forgive my pun. Forgive the pun, but they got you coming and going.
Boy, they sure do, Jill. Thanks a lot for the call.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. 1-800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke is here. James and Saugerties is there. You're on, James.
Hey, guys. How are you doing this afternoon?
Good.
Good. I recently have become the proud owner of a 1984 Volkswagen Vanagon.
Ooh.
And everybody loves the van, especially my mechanic. since I've acquired this vehicle, it's kind of been one thing after another. You know, I've been replacing fuel pumps, gas tanks, thermostats, oxygen sensors, et cetera, et cetera. Apparently also eventually the head is going to have to be replaced. My question is this. I am aware that it is a 30-year-old vehicle. I'm also aware that they are rather notorious for being quirky vehicles. Do I have this kind of thing to look forward to for the rest of my relationship with this car? Or can I look forward to a point where I've replaced almost everything and it'll be smooth sailing for me?
Well, I run into that a lot because people say, well, we've replaced just about everything. It's got to be good now. But as a vehicle ages, there are more new things that can and will crop up sooner or later. It's just the way mechanical devices are. The biggest thing that'll kill that probably is rust. And if it's not a rusty one, if it came from a rust-free state, you're in good shape there.
Yeah, the body is pretty darn free of rust.
Yeah.
There's a few little bubbles here and there, but it's the body is solid.
You could run into some, and I worked at a dealership in the late 80s where we had a lot of these water-cooled Vanagons, and there was quite a batch of head gasket issues with them, but they aren't just normal head gaskets by any stretch of the imagination. That's a massive job on that vehicle to do a reseal. So to answer your question, yes, it will continue to, things will continue to fail sooner or later, but keep driving it until it drives you absolutely nuts and then make the decision.
Or you drive it directly to the poorhouse. Yeah. I mean, that's the other option.
Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, they do have a little cult following, and they're very cool. The question is you know, is the money worth it to you, I suppose, to have a fun 1984 van?
Don't
right.
you have one?
I do. I've got a 78 and I've got a 66. They're both air cooled. They're older than
right.
this.
Of course, the advantage, James, is he does his own work on it. It's a little cheaper. Oh,
yeah.
Way.
He can come over to my place anytime.
Fair enough.
My mechanic says there's a reason that they call them the van again.
Yeah,
again.
Right.
Yeah.
Again.
Well, you could maybe look for a Volkswagen Thing next time. Do you remember that one?
I think there's probably a reason you don't see them anymore, right?
I'll bet Gordon has one of those, too.
I don't. They're rare.
Yeah. All right, James, thanks a lot.
I'm not crazy if I keep it?
Not yet.
If you like it and you can afford
exactly.
it.
Yeah, exactly. I got some crazy cars. Probably people wonder why I drive some of these things, you know?
Well, that makes me feel better.
Yeah.
All right, James, thanks a lot for the call. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. What's the craziest car you have?
Oh, boy. I don't know if I have anything that really crazy.
You
but
have a beautiful Riviera, I'll tell you that.
Yeah,
that's not crazy.
I've spread it out. I do have a big old nice U.S. muscle car.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And that is a car. In fact, I took a picture several months ago.
Yeah.
You were here. Took a picture of it, and I noticed Jessica, when she put the page up last time you were here.
She found it?
Found it and put it up.
Nice.
Oh, that's a car. What a car to drive. David in Saratoga Springs. David, you're on.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 2001 Volkswagen. That's a turbocharged four-cylinder. And when I start up the vehicle, I get a whine, and that was determined to be the secondary air pump. Now, I've... I had this problem before I switched to the K&N cone filter, but it says incorrect flow on the code. I'm wondering if that is due to the fact that the port is bigger for the intake and the incorrect flow might be too much flow.
Yeah, no, changing the air filter, it won't affect this. The secondary air pump picks up its air at the air cleaner housing, but it's a separate pipe, and it really doesn't matter too much what the air cleaner is all about in that case. That incorrect flow is a very, very common fault on those cars. Do you still hear the air pump making its whining noises?
I do. It starts up when you first start the car.
Yep.
And then about a minute later, it'll kick on for a much shorter time.
Yep.
And then it'll go away.
Yep.
I guess that's the only time you use it. But I've checked the hose, and there's no leaks in the hose. I did a smoke test, and I'm kind of baffled by it. So I'm wondering what you might.
This is what's probably wrong with it. If you go to where the fresh air mixes in with the exhaust, there's a valve there, and that valve has a vacuum hose on it, and that vacuum hose runs up to a solenoid that opens and shuts that thing. Those vacuum hoses notoriously crack, break, fall off, or leak, and when the system gets turned on, the vacuum is applied to open that valve, and it can't, so the computer doesn't know the difference. It just says we're not getting the airflow that we should through this system. So check that vacuum line and follow it all the way up to its connector at the solenoid, and you're probably going to have to replace that vacuum line.
Okay, and if not the vacuum line, then the valve
and
the solenoid?
Well, then there's some testing, because you don't want to guess and change all this stuff, but that vacuum connection is very, very popular to fail.
Okay.
All right. I appreciate the advice. Thank you.
David, thank you very much. Gordon Fricke is our guest. 1-800-348-2551. We go to Beth in Gilderland. Beth, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 2006 Forester that has 174,000 plus miles. It's had some work on it, and I keep track of the book value and everything. And I'm wondering, what are the symptoms of a possible clutch failure? Because that, in my mind, is the next big budget buster that could go wrong. It drives well, and I've been maintaining it.
Have you had the car since new?
Yes.
Okay. You are probably good with a clutch, because by now the wrong person would have been through more than one clutch. So clutches can last an incredible time. They can last the life of the car if they're used correctly, and if it's not an inherently weak design.
And how many hundreds of thousands of miles is the life of the car?
Really no mileage that you could say a clutch lasts, because it's an individual thing. It's how the operator uses it.
Mm-hmm.
Some symptoms would be slipping in your higher gears, step on the gas, and the tachometer races up, but the speed doesn't race up with it. Chattering, when you go to take off, the car shudders like crazy while you're...
The whole chassis shudders?
Yeah, while you're letting the clutch out to get moving.
Oh. Okay.
And noises. Step on the clutch pedal and you hear a lot of swishing and chattering sounds.
Oh.
I think if your clutch is... you're going to feel the symptoms. You're going to say, wow, something doesn't feel right.
Okay.
But if you're not having any of these happen, don't worry about it.
Okay, well, that's what I needed to hear.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks, Beth.
Very good. Thank you. Bye.
Bye now. Dennis in Oneida. Dennis, you're on.
Hi. I have a 06 Pontiac Vibe. So it's a close cousin of the Toyota Matrix, I guess. And I was just wondering about the timing belt, if it needs to be changed once I get up to near 100,000 miles.
Yeah, that is exactly a Toyota Matrix, just a little bit camouflaged, just the same car. An 06, I'm trying to think of the engine size, but I'm pretty sure that does have a timing belt. Have you looked into the fact that it does?
I have not.
Yeah, I mean, I think it does, and if it does, you really should look at the maintenance part of your owner's manual to see what they say for a replacement time, because it's going to be in months and or miles.
Sure.
Depending on, we get a lot of cars that have extremely low mileage on them, but they're really old.
Mm.
And the question then is, well, why should I change this timing belt? Well, that's because it's been on the car all these years, and it's subject to cracking and, just fatigue from its age. So a lot of cars, the interval is around 105,000. But look in your owner's manual to be sure, because I don't think the Toyota's that way, but some of the earlier Hyundais fooled a lot of people, and they were due at 60,000, where most everybody was already up into the 90 or 105 or 110,000 mile interval. So definitely
double check.
So once that happens on that on this type of car, is that a major disaster?
Yeah, it can be. Yeah, most engines now are the tolerances are so close that they call these interference engines. And if the belt were to break or even jump a bunch of teeth,
warps everything.
Well, the pistons can slam into the valves.
Ah.
And that alone doesn't sound good.
Okay.
Sounds very expensive.
Out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. We appreciate it. All right, Mr. Zach, let's take a break, and then we'll get back to more calls with Gordon Fricke. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Back. More Vox Pop coming up.
Support for WAMC goes from Curran Compliance Services, LLC, Greenwich, New York. Legal and consulting services on regulatory issues for life insurance and annuity manufacturers and distributors. CurranCompliance.com. The Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com. Ashokan Center, Olive Bridge, New York, a classroom in the wild helping schools, organizations, and individuals reconnect with nature, history, and the arts. AshokanCenter.org. And Richards Fuel and Heating, East Hampton, Massachusetts, providing high-efficiency gas and oil heating systems to the Pioneer Valley for over 45 years. Now expanding into the Westfield area, RichardsFuel.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Gordon Fricke is our guest, 1-800-348-2551. And Gordon, on the last show we talked, and we've talked about it on more than one show, about saving money by going down hills out of gear.
Yes, that's come up a bunch of times.
And we had an email from a guy who said, hey, hold the phone here. You explain.
Yes, yes. Well, I got the email, and the email talked about taking a vehicle and putting it in neutral,
yeah,
going down long, steep, hills to potentially save gas.
Right.
And the answer that I usually give is it probably will save some. How much is yet to be determined depending on the driving style, how long your hills are, what kind of car you have and all that. But the comment was it's illegal
in New York.
In New York State.
Wow.
So I looked up the law, and it really is.
It is illegal to drive, go down a hill in neutral.
Yes.
Wow.
Now, I don't know who's checking, but
the gear police, obviously.
But it is true, and it was not a very lengthy description reason, but they're saying to be able to maintain control of your vehicle at all times, it's important to keep it in gear in case you need to step on the gas to avoid something, and or it helps you decelerate, and you're not going to burn your brakes up going down a mountain, and then your brakes fade out, and now when you need to stop, you can't.
I see. So it's the Brake Protection Act.
I think that has a lot to do with it.
All right, fair enough. Jennifer in Hadley. Jennifer, you're on.
Hi, I'm just wondering if inspection laws vary from state to state greatly.
I think they may vary to some degree, but the only state that I've got any some experience with is Vermont, because we're very close. And every once in a great while, I'll have a vehicle that was either sold in Vermont and needed to be inspected in New York or vice versa, and something will crop up between the two states' requirements. But at one point, we were seeing a lot of vehicles with badly cracked brake hoses, and that's a major situation to remedy, and it won't pass inspection with a cracked brake hose. And we had a vehicle that was sold in Vermont State that came down for an inspection, and I said, we can't pass the vehicle. The brake hoses are incredibly cracked.
Yeah.
And apparently the selling dealer gave this person some trouble, saying, well, that makes no difference to Vermont State, and that's all we're going to adhere to.
Oh.
I checked with Vermont, and it was almost word for word the same as New York. So I'm sure they vary some, but I think the major safety items are all going to be about the same.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Because I was told with my seatbelt light that I by my mechanic that I wasn't going to pass. So that's actually good news.
In New York State?
And no, in Massachusetts.
Yeah. See, again, I don't know about Mass.
Okay. So it does vary then.
It can. Yes.
Okay. Right. Well, thank you.
Thanks, Jennifer. Now, I recall I lived downstate in the early 90s, and I think in some of the counties it. Your emission tests around New York City. I was in Westchester.
Yes.
And I think that there were emission tests there long before they were statewide.
Long before.
Yeah.
Downstate emissions came on much earlier.
Yeah.
And the cars at that time were required to go on a dynamometer.
I remember it.
Which is, at that time, was a $40,000 piece of equipment that you needed to purchase if you wanted to keep doing these inspections.
Yep.
And that has since been deleted because now it's a plug-in inspection now. It's done electronically.
Yep. Yeah, I remember that very well. Now, just another question about inspections before we get back to the phones. You're in Hoosick Falls. You're very close to the Vermont border. Is it possible for you to get registered as a Vermont inspection station as well, even though you're in New York?
No, you can only do the state that you are present in, that your facility is in.
All right.
Yeah.
Let's go to Eric in Boston. Eric, are you really in Boston?
I am in Boston right now, literally walking near Chinatown.
Okay, well, you're on with Gordon Fricke.
Oh, great. So I have a 2008 Honda Civic LX, and I get great gas mileage on the highway, 35, 38, fantastic. But for some reason, since I got the car last year, even when I was up in college, I get like 14 to 17 miles per gallon, like city driving, like local town, going to the shopping mall or whatever it is, it's terrible. And I've been monitoring it since approximately January.
Okay.
So the question is that normal for the car? Is that what you're looking for?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I've looked on forums and I've brought it into like my local shop and even the Honda dealer, and they can't see anything wrong with it. They said, you know, if you're getting great gas mileage on the highway, there's no reason to say, you know, there's anything wrong with it when you're in the city, but sure. That doesn't make sense to me.
Sure. Here's the way it works with city driving. City driving varies greatly from, quote, highway, because it depends a lot on how you drive the car in the city or in stop and go. If you accelerate like crazy from light to light, or if you're really hard on the gas and then hard on the brakes, or if you're super easy trying to be conservative, you're going to vary that city miles per gallon quite a bit, and it has to do with driving style. And I'm not trying to put the blame on you, but you could potentially drive that car in a different manner and get better city miles per gallon.
So I've done that. Like I've literally been as conservative as possible. You know, it's been happening for a long time, and I figured, you know, maybe it was just the winter at the time. But I mean, I've never gotten in the city once more than 17 miles per gallon.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when I'm at a stoplight, you know, I'll hear the engine revving up a little more than normal than I've ever heard. And also, you know, sometimes when I shoot out, even when I'm touching lightly, it'll jolt, you know, almost like something happening with the transmission, which I'm not sure of what's going on, you know.
How many miles are on your car, roughly?
About 135.
Hmm.
But, you know, those Hondas are supposed to last, right?
Oh, yeah, well, they certainly do. You know, it wouldn't hurt to make sure that everything is up to snuff in terms of spark plugs, air filter, you know, all of your, quote, maintenance, what used to be called tune-up items. And it wouldn't hurt to get the car kind of checked over and give it a good fuel injection cleaner. And just put something in the gas, a product that contains Tecron. It's a very strong fuel cleaner. I think you might be able to sharpen this car up a little bit.
Okay, like a fuel injection cleaner.
Yeah,
Do you think it could? My father said something about like the sensors. Could that be anything?
Well, there is a airflow sensor that can slightly get dirty and not turn on any warning lights, and that mass airflow sensor can be cleaned. I think you should bring it in and just see if they can sharpen up some stuff in hopes of improving your gas mileage.
All right. Okay, great.
Eric, thanks a lot for the call. Of course, cars, your gas mileage will get worse as the car gets older.
Yes, to some degree, because things aren't as efficient and new and sharp, and there's deposits built up.
Yeah,
definitely tire pressure, which I forgot to mention Eric. Make sure, and if he's still listening, that's great, but tire pressures have a major impact on fuel economy.
And city driving in general. I mean, my car will do 17 or 15, you know, between 15 and 19 in the city. You get it on the highway, 27, 28 is not a problem.
Yeah, major difference.
Stopping
and
going.
Hey, you know what just occurred to me, Ray? Are we now in the Boston area? Are we taking over Click and Clack's territory?
Well, they're retired.
Well, yeah. So
it's about time.
So now we got a guy in Boston listening to us.
You got to cackle more. All right, let's go to Philip and Leverett. Philip, you're on.
Hi there. I was calling because I recently was looking at a 1997 Geo Tracker, a four-door Geo Tracker, that actually got purchased before I was able to buy it. And it's the car that I'm pretty much set on wanting to buy. And I know they changed a lot after 1997. They were, I think, previously purchased by Chevy or run by Chevy. And so I'm having a hard time finding that vehicle in, you know, the Western Mass, New York, Connecticut area. And I was kind of curious on what your feelings are about driving pretty far out of state to find one of them. I'm finding a lot of them in West Virginia, Virginia, North Carolina, just a lot of southern states. And so I'm kind of curious, I know one of your previous callers mentioned something about inspection in between states, and if there's anything specifically I should try to pay attention to if I'm going to be thinking about buying one from out of state.
Sure. So the note that we have says Geo Tracker versus Chevy. You know they're the same thing. They just changed, they got the Geo name off the vehicle.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, and what I was reading, yeah, my question kind of changed a little bit as I was listening to your other callers. But I also read on some of the forums that the suspension and the chassis changed a little bit after 97, that they weren't as tough and rigid as they were previously. So I think that's going to stay before 1997.
Yeah. Yeah, what they did.
And that's what I'm having I'm finding a lot of the later ones in the area. I'm just having a hard time finding the earlier ones.
Yeah.
Anywhere in state.
They got a little bigger, so you want the little one, the earlier.
Yeah, I want
version.
The little ones because they're really great on gas, but they still have, you know, enough power that I can tow things with them and put them into four-wheel drive. And
yeah, if you are into or willing to travel to those southern locations,
mm-hmm.
that's of benefit to you because you're going to get one that's probably rust-free.
Yeah,
right.
And if you're okay with doing that, that's what I would do. I would try to find one south from here to get a rust-free vehicle.
And how, you know, like up here, if I was going to buy a used vehicle, I'd probably try to take it into somebody to have it looked at before I were to buy it.
Yep.
Is that something that's relatively easy thing to do? You know, because it's like I'm not going to necessarily want to travel down to West Virginia just to look at a car.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to want to go down there if I feel really confident that I'm going to buy the car.
Yeah. Now, there are agencies that will do used car inspections all over the country for you.
Okay.
And I don't know any names of them, but if you...
They're reputable?
Oh, yeah, yeah. If you, I know a guy that he was looking for... he wanted a Land Rover Discovery, and he was searching all over the place to get a rust-free one
mm-hmm.
in southern states. And he hired a company to go do pre-purchase inspections.
Huh.
They'll look the vehicle over. They'll tell you what they find. They'll give you a checklist. I think it's well worth it. Whatever it is, you don't have to travel, fly, or go down there to find out, forget it, this car's no good,
yeah. right.
or this one's excellent. I would look into that.
Used car pre-purchase inspection.
Yeah, and there are companies that do that. So if you got on the internet and just, you know, searched that, you'd find what I'm talking about.
Okay. Philip, thank you.
That helps a lot. Thanks a lot.
All right. Now, he mentioned the rigid suspension versus a less rigid. Is rigid more sporty? Like, if you had a sports car, would it have a rigid suspension?
Yeah, and what he's talking about is they changed that. The vehicle just took an evolutionary change, and it got a little bit larger and a little bit softer because the old ones were stiff. They were a rugged little vehicle, but they rode like a buckboard.
Okay, now I think of a stiff riding truck as a like a Jeep Cherokee. To me, that's a very stiff ride.
Well,
having
take
driven
it a step,
one of those.
Just take it a step further. Go to a Jeep Wrangler.
Okay.
You know, because you've got these off-road capabilities.
Yeah.
A lot of bounce, a lot of stiffness, but they're made to be able to bash through ruts and go over rocks
yeah.
and go through ditches and stuff like that.
I understand.
Yeah.
Let's go to Lawrence in Schenectady. Lawrence, you're on.
Yes. I got a Cherokee, Grand Cherokee 2002. It for very small trips, it seems to overheat. And I had the antifreeze flush through and everything, and thermostat changed and everything. I'm just wondering what you think. Someone told me there might be something similar on the passenger side headlight.
Yeah. What year is the Grand Cherokee?
02.
Yeah, I know exactly what they're talking about. You have an electric cooling fan, and that
right. They,
does
and
that
they come on? They come on, but it's so loud when they
yeah.
And like yeah.
Yeah. So what's happening is your fan is going past the first speed, and it's relying on the absolute high speed as if you were close to overheating. So
okay.
the low speed fan circuit is not working.
Okay.
And underneath the headlight on the passenger side behind the bumper cover is the module or the relay that controls the cooling fan. Those definitely are trouble. But it should be tested to make sure that's where your problem lies.
Trouble to fix or just trouble that
no,
they go wrong?
They fail.
Often.
They okay. fail. And then you'll lose your cooling fan. Sometimes they go haywire and the fan stays on all night and you end up with a dead battery.
Mm.
Other times they won't turn the fans on at all. So you're on the right track, but I think somebody should go in there and it's not very difficult to test it to make sure
okay.
that, and they may find out that that low speed circuit's gone.
Oh, okay.
All right.
And that'll give you that'll give you those symptoms.
Okay, thank you.
Lawrence, thank you very much. Boy, we're racing through the calls today. Steve on the road. Where are you on the road, Steve?
Heading back to Connecticut from upstate New York.
Okay, you're on with Gordon Fricke.
How's it going? I have a transmission question. I have a Dodge Ram that every 2 weeks or so, the check engine light pops up with the torque converter lockup check engine light. And they've tested it, and it always locks up as it's supposed to. They told me to try changing my O2 sensors because I guess there's a wire that's connected to them. But it always pops up. I was wondering if you had anything that might be fun to look at.
What year is the truck?
It's a 2001.
Okay. How many miles, roughly?
198.
Okay. That code that you have coming up comes on for what the computer does is it looks at the speed before and after, the speed of the engine before and after the torque converter. And if the difference is too great, it senses that the lockup portion of your torque converter is slipping. And that is not uncommon, especially with that age and mileage. And it doesn't mean that the transmission is definitely failing, but when that slips, it can create debris from the clutches in that torque converter. They darken up your transmission fluid. Now you got a lot of dirty junk going around in there, and the transmission can fail. So what you can do is a shop can take that out with a scan tool connected to it, get it in overdrive, and look at those two speeds. And then they can tell you, yes, you are, in fact, slipping in overdrive, and talk to you about your options at that point. So that can be happening.
Yeah, because actually they have looked at it while they drove it on a scanner, and everything checked out the way it's supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
And they said I could try changing the – there's a solenoid, I guess they said, in the transmission.
Yep, so lockup control solenoid.
Then the second thing that I'm worried about is I've had the truck for about 5 years, and with the mileage now I'm concerned, do I change that solenoid and change the fluid, and then 2 months later the transmission.
Talk to a transmission shop specifically and get their take on it.
All right, thanks a lot, and that's where we will have to leave it today. What's your website, Gordon? What's your Barber and Fricke website?
It is Gordon F at Barber Fricke. .com.
Okay, BarberFricke.com. Thank you very much for being here today. Support comes from Four Seasons Natural Food Store and Cafe, Saratoga Springs, New York. Locally owned and operated since 1988, open 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. 7 days a week. FourSeasonsNaturalFoods.com. Joyelle's Jewelers, Del Mar, New York, specializing in custom jewelry and repair, laser welding, designer jewelry, and gifts. JoyellesJewelers.com. Springhouse Spa, Sharon Springs, New York, a modern-day spa in an historic setting. Appointments and gift certificates available online, springhousespa.com. And Edward Garbosik, Certified Financial Planner, Havoc and Wealth Strategies, Wilbraham, Massachusetts, providing customized financial retirement strategies for those approaching or in retirement, havocandwealthstrategies.com. Thanks for being here today. Thanks to Zach Malloy at the controls. Phones answered today by Patrick Garrett. And our web wizard, if you will, is Tom Job. Jessica Blaustein Marshall, our producer. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's Moyers and Company. Have a great weekend. Medical Monday comes your way at this time on Monday.